Iran has just said they have a blockade and they have closed the Strait of Hormuz.
It's all just for show.
They could have easily been toppled had Obama shown, you know, a set of balls. I'm like, wow, you know, we can actually get away with this.
And one thing I will never understand, gentlemen, is how the left is actually has a pro-Iran stance. Innocent Iranians have been killed and brutally injured against trying to protest this regime. Think about all the different epicenters of state-sponsored terrorism that they have conducted.
It almost seemed as though the bombers had inside information. Most of us in that room knew at least one or more of the agency employees that were killed on that bombing day.
The second we knew that Iran was responsible for killing as many U.S. troops as they were in the Iraq war, I'm talking off the map, scorched fucking earth, to where they were never going to be a problem again in the region.
Certainly Russia and China, they will be moving quickly to try to have some influence in what happens once the Ayatollah is gone.
Yeah, we don't really have a choice here. It needs to be fast and swift.
This is definitely a inflection point in world history. I think it's time for the Iranian regime to be ended once and for all. Welcome to Proud American Studios for a new episode of The Forum. Today, we will talk about Iran and the escalation of the brutality of the Iranian regime against its people. Since 1979, Ayatollahs have established Iran as a state sponsor of terrorist groups. Today, the United States is sending an armada of Navy vessels to the Persian Gulf and Gulf of Oman regions. The tension is getting very high as Iranian people are fighting for freedom against this regime. Today, our panel will discuss these aggressions with Iran, how they've reached a boiling point, and much further. Appreciate you guys being on the panel again today.
Glad to be here.
Yeah, it's good to be here, Trey.
Yeah, kicking things off. So I'm sure you guys have heard the news. The Iran has just said they have a blockade and they have closed the Strait of Hormuz. So Dale, we'll kick it over to you from your intelligence background. What do you think the Iranians are really trying to accomplish with that?
I think it's more than anything, it's just for show. They don't have the capability to shut down the Strait of Hormuz, especially with U.S. naval forces in the area. So it's just a show thing, you know, to say, hey, look what we did. And then I would be surprised if there wasn't complete freedom of movement through the Strait of Hormuz right now. So.
No, absolutely. I think it's the, especially with the U.S. now sending a second, I believe, carrier battle group, over to the region. I think it's a true, FAFO moment for the Iranian regime. Mike, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I completely agree with you, Trey. It's all just for show. You know, they don't have the strength of the, or the military strength to be able to really do that. Plus all the other countries in the region, you know, obviously that's a huge, thoroughfare for major commerce around the world. So that threaten to shut that down, even for a few hours, will have a major effect on the world economy. So no, the United States and the other countries that are in the region are not going to let that happen.
No, I concur completely, gentlemen. Though, I think it's important for our viewing audience to really understand the backstory, because we're hearing so much about Iran in the news these days, all the different, terrorist organizations they sponsor, the attacks they've conducted all over the world. But that was not always the case. It wasn't until 1979 when the Ayatollah took over the Iranian government and made it a very oppressive regime. The U.S. used to have very strong diplomatic ties with Iran. In fact, personal story of mine, my wife's grandfather, my mother-in-law's father, was a retired Air Force colonel, and he was one of few guys at the time in the 70s before the Ayatollahs took over in the fall of the current, you know, the Shah that was over there. He was qualified to fly every single type of Iranian aircraft there was. He really, trained numerous Iranian pilots, and my mom spent a lot of her childhood in Lebanon when he was based out of the embassy there. So it has not always been cold and very distant diplomatic relations with Iran. So again, just want to give our viewing audience a little bit of backstory about really how the downfall of the Iranian country as a whole was the Ayatollahs in 1979. Ayatollah taken over. So, Dale, I'm going to pass the first question off to you. So can explain to our viewing audience why the Iranian people are rising up against this regime. And do you know from with your intelligence background, how many casualties you can say of innocent Iranians have been killed and brutally injured against the trying to protest this regime?
Well, the second part of your question first, at least tens of thousands. I mean, I don't know. I don't know that we have an accurate handle because on the number, because a lot of them disappear inside the notorious prison system and that, and they, you know, no one ever knows what happens to them. As far as deaths on the streets and that, you know, it's hard to give an accurate answer because, for one thing, the Iranian regime is going to downplay it. And for the other thing, the opposition is going to maximize it because they want it to look worse, you know, perhaps worse than it is, so that it'll generate international support. So it's hard to really give an accurate description, but I would think that at least, you know, in the tens of thousands, 20,000, 30,000, you know, probably is a close number.
Mm-hmm. And one thing I will never understand, gentlemen, is how some factions of U.S. population, usually the left, actually has a pro-Iran stance. So again, like our podcast we did several weeks ago, talking about what's going on in Minnesota, members of the political left want to complain about how ICE agents and federal law enforcement are conducting removal operations, but they are totally okay and supportive of how the Iranian regime is treating its own people. So, Mike, with your Homeland Security background, give the viewing audience your thoughts.
Yeah, they're really two different things, and it's amazing that the left is supporting what's going on. Our HSI and our ICE and our ERO agents are out there actually enforcing a law, and we're trying to make America safe, and we're trying to protect the everyday Americans. Whereas, you know, what's going on in Iran is totally different. Those people are protesting just the regime itself. And they're being brutalized and victimized just for being out there in the streets and for, protesting. Meanwhile, here in the United States, they have a problem with us just trying to enforce our laws. So yes, it's very interesting how political groups, especially the left, are flip-flopping on different, geopolitical events going on both here domestically and overseas.
So the regime openly chants death to America and death to Israel. So the Iranian regime funds and directs terrorist organizations such as Hezbollah, Hamas, and Palestinian Islamic jihadists like such as the Houthis. And really, from a national security standpoint, think about all the different epicenters of state-sponsored terrorism that they have conducted. So, Del, switching back over to you, in your opinion, this brutal oppression of their people and also some of their other state sponsors of terrorism, do you think that is their almost till they're going to die on, their last breath they're going to have trying to survive as a regime being a state sponsor of terrorism and also treating their own people that are protesting against them the way they are?
Well, absolutely. It's their only way to maintain power is to use brute force against their own people, you know, whenever they deem it necessary. You have to understand that this regime in Tehran is a radical fundamentalist Shia regime, and that they literally believe that they're on a mission from God. And, so they are going to use whatever force is necessary to maintain control over the people, to maintain control over the government. They have every intention to continue pursuing nuclear weapons. They have been pursuing nuclear weapons for years. Nothing has stopped them. And, they've done it in secrecy, and they're probably, even after we, blew the hell out of them, some months ago, they are committed to that, and they will turn around, and they've probably already begun to make preparations to, restart their nuclear program at the earliest opportunity.
All right, fellas, let's go back in time just a little bit to 1979 when Ayatollah Khamenei took over control of the country with the help of the Shiite Islamic groups. Do you believe the revolution was hijacked by radical clerics from what its initial intent was supposed to be when the current regime took over? Del, what are your thoughts?
Well, I mean, when the Ayatollah Khamenei returned to Iran after the Shah left, that was the beginning of what ultimately became the theocracy that has been running Iran ever since. And at least initially, there was broad public support because the Shah certainly governed, by you know, with a hard fist or whatever. You know, he was, it was a repressive regime. You know, political prisoners were jailed and tortured. And certainly, you know, there were some, you know, the people that were the rising up to support Khomeini's return to net were looking for a change. I don't think that they anticipated what the change was going to be, that it was going to become this hardline radical Islamic regime that that literally changed life overnight from more of a Western influenced population to one that you know, that was no longer acceptable. You had to toe the hardline Islamic line in order to survive in Iran.
Well, yeah, very, very good points there. So how do you think the 444-day hostage U.S. hostage crisis shaped the regime's long-term hostility towards the United States?
Well, I mean, that was, you know, once it was called, the Long American Nightmare, you know, and that lasted for 444 days, as you mentioned. I was overseas. I was in Frankfurt, Germany at the time when the Iranian hostage took place. And, you know, so obviously there was a lot of things that were going on that were actually based in Frankfurt that were targeting the Iranians and trying to locate and identify where the hostages were, much of it in preparation for the ultimate hostage rescue mission, Operation Eagle Claw, that occurred. And so, I mean, it was a time that Americans at home were, you know, we were embarrassed on the world stage because, to use the Iranian, the Ayatollah's own words, he referred to us as a paper tiger. And it was, mm-hmm. It was pretty much true. We had shown no sudden, you know, balls, at all in responding to it. And, you know, in talking with interviews with some of the quote unquote students that, that were involved in the takeover, they truly, expected us to respond immediately and with force. And they were going to quickly, you know, give up the hostages than had we done so. But once they saw that we were not going to respond, that we didn't respond, it just emboldened them. They're like, wow, you know, we can actually get away with this. And it carried on for 444 days until, then, you know, President Ronald Reagan was, sworn in office, and the Iranians viewed him as someone that was not going to just sit back and allow the United States to be slapped around the way that President Jimmy Carter did.
Now, you bring up a really good talking point there as well, Dale. Operation Eagle Claw. So I bet I think a lot of our viewing audience does not know exactly what that operation is. So it is classified as the failed Iranian hostage rescue attempt when our embassy personnel were taken hostage. And what I always like talking about it when I, you know, mention, you know, military history, we talk about American perseverance, American overcoming the odds, and America always really adapting to become the greatest nation to this day, the greatest nation on earth. Do you guys know by chance the biggest military change or what came of the failed hostage rescue, the failed Operation Eagle Claw, and how that really shaped special operations forces, even leading into the 80s and 90s, and also with the present day GWAT? You know what the biggest lessons learned, what was created from the Operation Eagle Claw that was a failure?
Must be something with Delta, I'm assuming, yeah, but I'm not sure.
Yep, part of it, yep. So that's when JSOC was established. Yeah. So Delta Force was established in 1977. After the failed operation in 1980, JSOC, the Joint Special Operations Command, was officially founded. And then later on that fall, SEAL Team 6 was established as well, too. So from that failure, the U.S. government, the U.S. military, identified a weak point, and where kind of bilateral or multilateral, almost like a mutual aid type operations capacity for example, a joint task force needed to be created for these exact types of you know special mission units, and their capabilities coming on. So
Trey, we can blame Iran for creating these badass teams of motherfuckers that have been kicking ass around the world for the last 40 years or so.
Technically, yes. So we'll continue to talk about that in our timeline with Iran here as well too. But no, 100%, we can thank the Iranian regime for the creation, 1979, for the creation of what is arguably the most lethal and effective military unit in this world has ever seen, the Joint Special Operations Command. So, Dale, I'm going to turn this one back over to you. I know this is going to hit near and dear to your heart. So again, we talked about, ahead of time how this affected you personally. But in 1983, Hezbollah, widely linked to the Iranian Revolutionary Guard, killed 241 Marines in the Beirut barracks bombing. Will you please share with our audience your personal connection to this? And why do you think the regime hates America as much as I do at that point, even leading up to current day's events?
Well, I mean, prior to the bombing at the Marine barracks, the Iranians had supported or backed up the bombing of the U.S. embassy in Beirut. And one of the individuals that worked in that embassy was a very good friend of mine. We had worked together in Frankfurt, and he had left Frankfurt to take a senior position in Beirut. It's kind of a funny story. I'm a little bit of a cartoonist by hobby ever since I was a kid growing up. And when I was in Frankfurt,
I must say, I hate to interrupt you, but you're a man of many talents. I must say, brother, there's all sorts of stuff you got going on. But anyways, continue. Sorry to interrupt.
But
cartoonist wasn't on my bingo card. I must say that's right.
Yeah, I can see it though.
Most of the stuff I've done has been to lighten the atmosphere at work. Cartoons that only people at work would really understand or appreciate. Mm-hmm. And I had a lot of fun with it. And people seemed to get a kick out of it. So I would do one occasionally and surreptitiously posted on the bulletin board with no signature. Eventually they found out who it was, but I had drawn a caricature, a poster sized caricature of the Ayatollah Khomeini with this studly bald eagle flying over his head and dropping a load of crap on top of the Ayatollah.
Nice.
And my buddy, he loved it. He thought it was great. Now, I was going to throw the darn thing away. And he asked if he could have it. He said he was going to have it framed, which he ended up having it framed. And it went down to Beirut with him. And he told me it was hanging on his office in the embassy there in Beirut, hanging on the wall. And so assuming it was there when the embassy got bombed, and of course he was killed. And that's my personal connection. And I tell you, it was
Dell, back up just so the audience completely understands. You had a close associate with you that you'd worked together for how many years did you say? Did you know him?
I knew him for several years, but we worked directly together for 2 years in Frankfurt.
2 years prior?
Yeah.
Peter Frankfurt. And then he was one of the Americans killed in that bombing.
Yes,
bombing.
He was the chief of station.
Wow.
And went to Beirut to accept the chief of station position. And the interesting thing about that bombing was it almost seemed as though the bombers had inside information, because where they hit, where they drove the truck into the embassy and that, there were a number of CIA employees that were killed. So it wasn't just him. It was probably, I think, if I remember correctly, it was at least half of the agency contingent that was in Beirut at the time. So that was, like I said, and by that time I was in Lisbon, Portugal. And I remember when the chief of station there called us all into his office he had gotten a communication in about the bombing in Beirut. And of course, he read off the names and everything. And of course, it was a pretty dark day for us, because most of us in that room knew at least one or more of the agency employees that were killed in Beirut on that bombing day. So,
and I think that's something for our viewing audience to really understand, because most times when members of the IC, the intelligence community, do pay the ultimate price in service to their country, their names are not necessarily officially released, or at a minimum, they're not released in the capacity they are serving because they're under some sort of cover program. U.S. military personnel, obviously declared. Other members of the State Department, yes, their names usually get released at government alphabet agency affiliation they're with. But that's something I think the viewing audience really needs to understand, just the selfless sacrifices that not just the U.S. military has made throughout the creation of the birth of this country, but also members of the IC intelligence community that most Americans will never hear at all.
Let me add this, Trey. A lot of people, or most people, probably aren't aware of the fact But there's a memorial wall in CIA headquarters. Little star, black stars are etched into the wall, and each one commemorates an agency employee who died in the line of duty. Well, there's also a booklet that is nearby where you can see the names of the individuals and, you know, their dates of service or whatever, where they were killed at the time. Some of the names in that book are still, just says not identified, after decades, because the fact that if they were to be identified, it would possibly compromise an operation that might be ongoing that has been going on for years. So, so it's just a little note that, that people, like I said, probably aren't aware of. So
really appreciate you sharing that. Mike, would you have something to, what do you have to add?
I was just going to say, a lot of people don't know, the intelligence community, the IC, is a really small knit group of men and women as well, American heroes, but they're really, so they all get to know each other, and Del can expand on this, but they definitely get to know most others that are in the IC, and they're constantly being stationed at different places around the world. So they're interacting with these people. So when they lose one of their brothers or sisters in a, in an environment like this, especially, you know, the coast bombing, right? Lebanon, it really hits hard. And I've seen it firsthand. It impacts because everybody kind of knows each other at some point or another in their careers.
Yeah, and for our viewing audience, what Mike was referring to, the coast bombing, so that was FOB Chapman in Khaws Province, Afghanistan, where a strategic IC base that had U.S. military personnel staged at it as well became victim of a suicide attack. So the chief of base, multiple members of the IC community, also with some military members, were killed or severely wounded in that. So again, just kind of talking about the aspect of what Mike was referring to. So fellas, let's switch gears here and kind of talk a little bit about from the early 2000s to mid 2000s on with what Iran has done. So again, with the invasion of Iraq in March of 2003, initially the U.S. military and the IC community was dealing with the Saddam regime. But soon after the collapse of the Saddam's regime, and also in addition to the Sunni tribal, terrorist uprising, we also, the U.S. military personnel and the IC, were dealing directly with the Iranian insurgency aspect as well. Again, like for folks that do not know in our viewing audience, most of Iran is kind of Shiite-backed, the religious from the, from Islam, and Iraq at the time was Sunni. It's almost like the best way to describe it is Christians versus Protestant. I'm sorry, under Christianity, you have Catholics and Protestants. That's about the best way I could compare, Shiite and Sunni within the Islam religion. So again, also you had Arabs, pretty much the dividing line. Iraq West is, Arab culture, and Iran East is, the Persian culture. Until you get to Afghanistan, you have like some Farsi, Dari, Pashtun, other aspects. So, but really kind of zeroing in on that mid-2000s time frame when Iraq was starting to spiral out of control, not just with the Sunni uprising, but also the Iranian insurgency, really in particularly the lethal aid that they were providing the Iranian insurgency backed groups in Iraq to target U.S. troops. So Del, I'm going to pass this question over to you first. Do you think the U.S. government and the military should have done more against the Iranian regime, especially during the height of the Iraq war when the Iranian insurgents were attacking U.S. troops with specialized EFPs, that stands for explosively formed projectiles, that were specifically designed to defeat our heavy armor?
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly some things we could have done. For one thing, and during the Obama administration and that, when they had the, I can't remember the name, it was called something, it wasn't the Arab Spring, but it was an uprising that took place in Iran at the time, similar to what's going on now. And we didn't do anything. We gave no support whatsoever. They were literally murdering, Iranians. Yep. In the street.
Del, to correct you real quick before you get too much farther, that actually was part of the Arab Spring. But we'll talk about that a little bit later. But yeah, you're spot on. Arab Spring was mostly the what happened in Libya was the main Arab Spring uprising, got all the attention. But the Iran regime was pretty close to falling from what we'd heard from intelligence sources. And they probably could have been pushed over the top if we had a little more of a Western involvement. So go ahead on that one.
Yeah, they were at the tipping point, and they could have easily been toppled had Obama shown a set of balls and done what needed to be done. But unfortunately, we had a, similar to Jimmy Carter, we had a weak president. And, so anyway, we missed that opportunity when we could have, I think would have easily been successful. Certainly we had activities going on targeting Iran. We've had them, ever since the Iranian Revolution. But some covert operations or covert action operations in that, are one step short of going to war. And, a lot of times, there's that you get right up to the edge and then you back off because, again, there's lack of intestinal fortitude or whatever you want to call it. And that was the problem, I think, with Obama. George Bush he was just, basically trying to avoid spreading the Iraq war even further into an entire Middle Eastern conflagration, which very, very possibly could have occurred. So, we've missed opportunities. I certainly hope we don't miss this opportunity because, we are on the cusp of seeing the world's foremost sponsor of international terrorism and the biggest threat to, having Middle East peace process finally succeed, if we let this chance get away from us.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, great insight. Mike, from your perspective, do you think that the U.S. government, in particular the U.S. military, should have done more against the Iran regime back in the mid-2000s during the height of the Iraq war?
Yeah, my personal opinion, that was the time where the hammer should have been dropped. I could speak from my perspective, being an HSI special agent at that time. HSI had groups around the country called counterproliferation centers, where we were trying to stop the flow and the export of goods and commodities to majorly Iranian-backed organizations like Hamas and Hezbollah at the time. And what they were doing, these networks who were highly funded, were obtaining American components, everything from cell phones to computers, laptops, in all different types of technologies, but in this particular area. And they were shipping them overseas, and then they were using that tech and reverse engineering things to create these types of explosive devices and stuff that were being used against our troops. And there were some great investigations by HSI guys around the country at that time to kind of thwart and not only take away, we were doing financial investigations into these organizations and also the export themselves. It's obviously a sanctioned country and OFAC was covering that at the time. And we were attacking all those networks, trying to shut down, these components because we knew what the end user was, these bombs in Iran or in Iraq. Yeah.
Yeah, appreciate that insight. I just want to read off a few statistics for our viewing audience. I looked up before our podcast, our panel here, fellas. Between 2005 and 2011, the EFPs, explosive form projectiles, very specific niche IEDs, improvised explosive devices that were specifically made by the Iranian regime and given to the technology and explosives was given to the Iranian insurgency groups. Between 2005 and 2011, these bombs were responsible for at least 196 U.S. troop deaths and the severely wounding of at least 900, accounting for a significant portion of total coalition forces casualties within the Iraq war. So again, this kind of like with Dell with the embassy bombing, this topic hits very close home to me as well, because I had several former teammates and also from my community, my former life, and also other communities we worked directly with that sustained life altering or even worse, to pay the ultimate price, be specifically from these the EFPs, explosive form projectiles. The Iranian, mad scientists, for lack of better terms, how they were creating the EFPs, how it was specifically designed. They knew they could not defeat our heavy armor with your traditional type of explosive, so they packed closely formed projectiles that actually would punch through our armor. Even more so, during one of my Iraq deployments, we knew that we added the slant armor would slant armor that which would have the offset to help stop some of the EFPs. And literally, the Iranians and some of their backed Shiite militia groups actually started targeting the turret gunners with those EFPs or explosive form projectiles. But hey, we knew we can't punch in to the actual through the armor, so we're actually, you know, with the with our EFPs with the additional kind of slant, you know, kind of the armor on the side, give that offset. But they would start targeting the turret gunners and some of the heavy armor vehicles. So, in my opinion, fellas, I mean, you talked about, I guess, Adele, you mentioned testicular fortitude. I like to actually refer to that as political fortitude. There should have been a political fortitude to deal with Iran directly back then. If you had asked me, the second we knew that Iran was responsible for killing as many U.S. troops as they were in the Iraq war, we should have absolutely decimated their military. We should have bombed them back to the Stone Age. I'm talking off the map, scorched fucking earth, to where they were never going to be a problem again in the region.
Let me ask you this, because you're a, Trey, you're a sailor. You know, it baffles me to this day why we have not destroyed the entire Iranian naval fleet. I mean, they've got a small navy, and you've got all these little boats running around that were annoying the crap out of U.S. naval vessels, and they were not allowed to blow them out of the water. You know, that's one of the things we should do right now. If this thing comes to actual blows, I mean, we need to blow every one of them little speedboats out of the water. They have a couple of larger naval vessels, which would be easy pickings, and they need to be sunk. And you know, those are the kinds of messages sent that Iran, the Iranian people would appreciate. You know, and the IRGC is in fact, I used the term before, what they thought of us as a paper tiger. The IRGC is a paper tiger. They will drop their weapons and run if this revolution gains steam. They really will. Yes. So, you know, we need to force the issue. And I'm certainly hopeful that day is coming.
Just one more point I want to make about these EFPs. You know, in order for them to have that technology on the ground in Iraq to be used against, our troops, it has to be financed, right? The tech, the knowledge, the academia part of it, just being able to put together all of these, they're relatively advanced, you know, focused munitions. In order to have it, you have to be financed. And Iran was behind the financing for most of this. And I think it came out later as these types of investigations took place, the military side of it, and also FBI, BIS, who's Bureau of Industry and Security here in the U.S., U.S. Commerce Department and HSI, started to go into the financials of all these organizations, you know, the Hezbollahs and Hamases and the Iranian regime, started looking at the how the money moved around, and it became very evident that Iran was behind the financing of all of these weapons. And we brought this up before, but I think that's really important for the Americans to understand that, you know, how brutal they can be as a nation.
No, absolutely. And Dale, you mentioned the IRGC. So for the folks that are viewing audience that does not know what the IRGC stands for, so it stands for the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. And in particularly, I was just talking about the EFPs and the amount of U.S. troops that were killed by them. Talking about political fortitude, actually having a president that did have the political fortitude to do something about it. When the Iranian Major General Qassem Soleimani was killed in an airstrike on January 3rd, 2020, he was known as the mastermind of the EFP during the height of the Iraq war. So again, he should have been killed. He should have had a warhead through his forehead at least 10 years prior, if not sooner than that. So also, if folks do not know who exactly what position that Soleimani had, he was the member of the Quds Force, which is one of five branches within the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. And they specialize in unconventional warfare and military intelligence operations. General Stanley McChrystal pretty much described the Quds Force as a combination between the CIA and the Joint Special Operations Command, similar mission sets within the Iranian government. So just want to have our viewers understand that background of exactly some of the acronyms we're talking about.
And sadly, we actually captured some Quds Force members in Baghdad. And of course, you know, we didn't have the balls to deal with them as they should have been dealt with. They were eventually released.
So I'll do one better for you.
Oh, go ahead. I was going to say the Quds Force guys, they're the real deal guys. They're special operations, a combination of them and CIA. They answer directly to the Ayatollah, and they're his kind of like called secret warriors or whatever, but they've been responsible for numerous insurgencies around, you know, the Middle East over the last 20 years.
All right, fellas, with you bringing that up, I'm going to break one of my own kind of cardinal rules about not talking about specific operational details in public settings. But I think it's important for the folks, the viewing audience, to really understand this. So, Dale, when you talk about, Quds Force and the lack of political fortitude to actually do something about them, one of my deployments to Iraq, where we were doing the counter-Iranian insurgency mission set, we had been following a Quds Force commander that was operating in Iraq. We knew that was providing EFPs and other financing to the Shiite Iranian backup militia groups. So we got word through the IC of exactly where he's gonna be coming from. So we set up a snap checkpoint. Again, we'd been watching him the day prior, you know, knew he was on the move, knew he had a group of guys with him as well. We set up a snap checkpoint. We are able to stop that vehicle, detain them, get everyone out, start questioning them. Yeah, sure enough, it was the Quds Force commander. And then so again, that's one of the guys that walks up to not brand new guys, but one of the kind of mid-level, not one of our senior guys. He's like, hey, I need to talk to your commander right now, speaking perfect English. And the guy's just like, they're like, hey, get back over there, you know, keep your hands up, yada, yada. And this individual says, I am the deputy ambassador to Iran. So literally at a snap checkpoint, and we rolled up a Quds Force commander with the deputy ambassador of Iran to Iraq. And so again, obviously at that point in time, we pretty much had a diplomatic operation we needed to figure things out. So bottom line up front, at the end of the story, questioned the guys for a little bit, but we were told we had to let them go because the Quds Force commander being with that diplomat, the deputy ambassador, he technically fell under diplomatic immunity at the time. So, frustrating to say the least.
You know what the answer
on that one. So
the answer to that is two to the chest, one right between the headlights, and toss them on the side of the road. Okay, so
yeah, I get it. Like, I mean, honestly, that would the criteria for that to be them to be conducted with an airstrike nowadays, or even lethal force, deadly force, would definitely have that matrix was met. By today's standards for sure. So again, kind of different times, even during the height of the Iraq war, some of the rules we had to deal with. So, moving on, fellas. So the, Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps we've been talking about, designated as by the United States as a terrorist organization. How dominant is the IRGC inside Iran's political economic structure, not just their military structure? Dale, I'll start with you with your intelligence background. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, they take their guidance from the senior leadership, all the way up to the Ayatollah. I mean, they're technically a military force, but, they serve a combination of military, police, National Guard. I mean, they're right now in the streets of Tehran, killing Iranian citizens and that. So they're a multifaceted group, I guess, is what you would say. And certainly they have some commitment to the Iranian cause, but I am firmly convinced that they will drop their weapons and run, if they are confronted by any sizable, opposition. So, their commitment's about, skin deep. So.
The joke where when the U.S. first invaded Iraq in March of 23, the running joke was amongst the U.S. military is how fast the Iraqi military was going to surrender when they knew the power and might of the U.S. military had crossed over the border and entered Iraq. So, again, fellas, let's talk about how the fanatic regimes, how they're utilizing their nuclear capability, or at least attempting to, advance their nuclear capability. If this extremist regime were to acquire a nuclear weapon, do you all think it would be used against the United States, Israel, and or Europe? Mike, I'm going to start with you from a homeland security perspective. Do you think if the regime would ever come across and have the capabilities of utilizing a nuclear weapon, would they use it, first of all? And then how at what capacity would they use it first?
Sure. I mean, I don't think they were that far away from having one not too long ago. Obviously, the 12-day war kind of put a big damper in that plan. But I don't know the newest intel on all that, but I wouldn't say they're that far away from the last that I knew. And would there, if they had that capability, yes, I believe absolutely they would use it. Israel would probably be their first target. Let's be honest. Everybody knows that. If they have the capability of ICBMs and they could launch a little bit further, Europe is definitely on the list. Mm-hmm. And obviously the United States, if they could somehow get one within our shores, or set up offshore somewhere down in the Caribbean and had the capability of getting one here. Do I think they would use it? 1,000%. I mean, that regime has proven, you know, time after time that, you know, they don't listen to, the only thing they listen to is force. And that's it. So their own force, utilizing their own force, or their force of other countries trying to stomp them down or protect themselves. So, yeah, to answer your question, 100%.
Yeah, Dell, over to you for your thoughts.
Yeah, well, fortunately for us, at least right now, they're a little bit behind the curve on delivery systems. So for them to be able to reach us in that, you know, I think we're safe for the moment. But obviously Israel is their primary target. I mean, you know, yes, we're the great Satan, but Israel is the little Satan. Israel is in the region. I foresee you know, that they ever were able to get the, nuclear weapon, that, you know, probably, you know, obviously Tel Aviv or the port, or not port city, I guess maybe it is a port city. Haifa on the coast would be a potential target. I don't see them going after Jerusalem because that's where their third holiest shrine is, you know, for Islam is in Jerusalem. But certainly Tel Aviv and Haifa would be, I think, very high on the list. Haifa maybe even more so because, like, as I said, it sits right on the coast, and there's a number of potential delivery systems that they could use to get it in close enough proximity to where we'd have some damage.
Yeah, I believe it was the former Iranian president Ahmadinejad, if I'm pronouncing his name correctly, that actually was quoted saying Israel was a stinking corpse. So that just shows you the extremism right there and their willingness, if they ever did get a weapons of mass destruction, a nuclear weapon of some sorts, what exactly their intent would be to use it for. Fellas, how do you think the relationship between the Russia and China, you know, it'd be like strengthening the regime is important to their survival?
Well, certainly Russia and China have interest in what's going to happen in Iran. And certainly they are, you know, they're fine with the current regime because the current regime looks to them for support. So, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, but I do believe that, China buys a shitload of oil from the Iranians and that, in violation of all sanctions, which don't necessarily mean anything to Russia and China anyway, but certainly they're in favor of it. I mean, they would like things to remain status quo, but, you know, they also are adept at being quick on their feet. So if there is a regime change, you know, they will be moving quickly to try to, you know, certainly have some influence in what happens, once the Ayatollah is gone. So, you know, you never can count them out. Like I said, they oftentimes, I think the Chinese and the Russians, respond much quicker than we do. We're sometimes thoughtful to a detriment. So.
I think a lot of it's just the political factions within the U.S. government fighting each other as why there's the bureaucracy and the slow to respond at times. All right, fellas, switching gears here. Let's talk about Iran's terrorist networks of proxies, in particular Hamas, Hezbollah, and the Houthis, how they represent threats not just to the U.S., the homeland, but also abroad. So again, for our viewing audience that does not know or is not sure, Hamas is basically some of the Iranian-backed terror group that conducted the October 7th attack in Israel. They're pretty much operate out of the Gaza Strip and the West Bank with their leadership in the country of Qatar. Hezbollah is a Iranian-backed Shiite militia group out of the Lebanon area to the north of Israel. And then the Houthis are a Shiite group backed by Iran that works operates in the northern and central Yemen regions, in particular the capital in Sana'a. So again, like Mike, I'm gonna pass it over to you first. How do you think Iran's terrorist networks not just affects us, you know, from overseas U.S. interests, but potentially domestically abroad, domestically too?
Yeah, I mean, obviously it's on the radar of federal law enforcement across the United States. We're always worried about that, you know, terrorist hit anywhere here, right? And any of these groups are capable, theoretically, of carrying out some sort of an attack. You know, there's individuals from each one of these groups present here in the United States and our major cities and even in smaller towns that could be called up at any time. And I'm not trying to scare people, but the FBI is very good at keeping an eye on them, Homeland Security and other entities here within the United States. But it's a threat to us. I mentioned earlier, they're financing. They're well financed from countries like Iran and other countries in the Middle East. They also are well financed from here in the United States, you know, so there's a lot of, Lebanese populations and other Middle Eastern types of groups here in the United States that make money at doing legal and illegal things here in the United States. And then they send these monies back overseas. They launder the money out of the country and they go to these organizations. So they're well financed all the way around, you know. So I think we have to continue to be diligent and identify these groups, try to, on the state, local, and federal level here in the United States, try to keep them at bay, and keep an eye on their financing. The banks, we have a great relationship with banks here in the United States, anti-money laundering types of organizations and whatnot here in the U.S., where banks let us know a lot, and banks themselves really have departments that keep an eye on everything, right? Narco trafficking and whatnot, but also terrorist financing. So it's a big component of us here domestically keeping us safe. So is there a threat? Yeah, 100%. We need to be diligent with it. There's also the threat overseas for, you know, our bases and different types of, organizations and groups that we're responsible for overseas too. So I think it's a big problem, and we really need to continue to be diligent investigating those types of things.
No, I appreciate that insight there, brother. Dell, over to you. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, if we could just get Hezbollah to answer their pagers, you know, I mean, that would be good. So.
There you go. Yeah.
You know, the thing that people need to understand is, and be concerned about, is Hezbollah has a large presence in the Western Hemisphere. One of the islands that and I can't recall the name of it, but it's one of the islands that's a property of Venezuela. Was basically a Hezbollah base. They had all sorts of activities going on that island, and certainly with the 4 years that the Biden administration, you know, we had an open border. You know, who knows how many Hezbollah agents or Al Qaeda or Al Shabaab? I mean, you name it. We, you know, the thing that and Mike probably can really comment on this. The question I always had, or people would ask me about, in that is, they said, "What are these gotaways in that?" And I used to tell them, you know, the 4 years we had an open border, nobody had to sneak into America. You just go up to a checkpoint. And you were allowed in the country and given a date, a couple of years down the road or whatever. So why would it be necessary to sneak across the border into the United States unless you had something to hide? And as I said, Mike probably can comment even more about that, because I think that's something we really have to be concerned about. There's over a million people that snuck into this country during the Biden years.
Well, yeah, I mean, a lot more than a million. Dell, tens of millions probably. And again,
at least tack a zero behind that.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, what did it take? You know, 19 hijackers, right? That, was the largest terrorist attack here ever in the United States. So it doesn't take a big, component, but when we're just have a free and open borders and people could just come and go as they please. It's the finance cells that you really have to, worry about when it comes to these types of, organizations. You mentioned Al-Shabaab before in Minnesota, and that was a big part of what Trump's plan was in Minnesota. People don't realize, all the Somalis that are up there. These guys are all funneling money back to their home country. They're all working in these like delis or smoke shops or different types of things, and they're putting the money and they're sending it back home to that to a terrorist organization, basically. And again, I say all. I'm not saying all, but a large faction of them. So that's a huge threat and risk here to the national security of the United States.
No, great points, gentlemen. Let's talk about actual present day. In fact, what's currently going on right this second. A lot of sources are saying that, hey, there could be military action taken against Iran within a matter of days, if not hours. Do you guys think the Iranian regime really wants a deal? Or they're just going to kind of keep pushing the kicking the can down the road, just trying to call the President Trump and the U.S. military and the U.S. government, as long as the Israeli government's bluff?
Well, let me ask a question. The Iranian regime is a theocracy, and they call the United States the Great Satan. Can you visualize them signing an agreement with Satan? You know, absolutely not. Anything that the Iran, and they've done this for decades, where they will agree to any kind of document to sign it. They don't care. They view it as nothing more than an opportunity to buy them time as they pursue their ultimate goals, which is the destruction of Israel and to harm the United States. So, you know, there's no sense, as far as I'm concerned, in negotiating. We shouldn't be negotiating. We should be telling flat out, this is what you're going to do. And if you don't do this, adios, pal, you're going to be gone. You know, I know it's easy for me to sit here in my home in America, you know, and say that we should be, you know, taking military action against, because it's people like yourself, Trey, and my grandson who are out there on the front lines that are going to be called upon to carry these missions out. But I think it is in our national interest to finally rid the world of the Iranian problem. And the only way that we're going to be able to do that is to take out the leadership. That's the only solution, because they will just use it as a, delaying tactic. Any conversations and negotiations. So,
like we've talked about before, just trying to wait to the next U.S. election and see how things pan out. Mike, over to you. What are your thoughts on? Do you think Iran actually wants to make a deal, or are they just going to try to keep buying more time as much as they can?
I think they definitely want to make a deal, but I have the same opinion as Dell. It's just to buy more time. It's, they'll make a deal with us, but they'll turn around and completely, ignore the deal. It's like sanctions, right? One of our strongest tools in Iran is our sanctions, right? OFAC and shutting down pretty much anything going in and out of that country. It's a very effective tool, and it really does bleed out, the Iran. Unfortunately, they're the good people of Iran are being harmed in that way. And it's the Ayatollah's ego that's getting the best of him, and it's really hurting the people. But, with sanctions, they'll sign deals, or we'll impose sanctions on them. They don't give a shit. It costs them money. It costs them products and commodities, but they're really just waiting, slowly developing their programs so that they can, come in and be the next big thing and have that nuclear weapon is what they seem to strive for as a complete country, So yeah, I think it'd be great to have a deal, if I thought they'd actually abide by the deal, then I'd say yes, but I know they wouldn't. So.
Yeah, I think the recent Operation Midnight Hammer, where the U.S. Assisted the Israeli Defense Forces in bombing the specific targeted nuclear sites of Iran, I really thought at that point in time the regime would take a hard step back and be like, man, this is kind of an uphill battle that we are going to lose directly. But I guess the defiance of the regime, their attempt to just stay in power to the very last minute is going to be their ultimate downfall.
They're on a mission from God. They're on a mission from God, so they're not going to walk away from it. They'll sign any document. They'll agree to anything, but they have no intention on abiding by it. So, I mean, that's why any signed agreement with them is worthless.
All right. Now, I'm going to play devil's advocate just for a second, fellas, just because of the topic of conversation happened with Iraq. Okay, yeah, you break it, now you bought it. If the U.S. military, in conjunction with the Israeli Defense Forces, if we take military action and overthrow, topple the Iranian regime, decimate them to where literally the people of Iran take over, how do we know that even a crazier group, a crazier faction within Iran may not take hold? It's kind of one of those sayings, hey, it's the devil versus the devil you don't know. What do you think the steps the U.S. can take to prevent that from happening if we do, in fact, topple the regime and really turn it over back to the Iranian people? Dale, I'll start with you.
One thing that I have actually mentioned this in a different interview that I did not long ago, but I go back in history, and no, I wasn't there, okay? But people will from their history books remember about the Berlin airlift, when the Soviet Union blocked off all traffic into West Berlin. And the people of West Berlin were starving. I mean, they had no medical supplies, no food, no water. And the Berlin Airlift was created to bring supplies in that to keep the people of Berlin alive. And that was the purpose was, you know, the reason the Soviets did it was they felt that West Berlin would succumb to their influence in that and they would be able to take control over, you know, over the Western side of the city, and the city as a whole. I would advocate for the same thing or something very similar, because right now Iran's economy is in a shambles. Okay. They have no supplies, people are indeed having difficulty even feeding their families in that. So we may want to consider something similar to a Berlin airlift, but where we are able to bring in supplies, you know, in each one of those boxes of supplies is going to have a great big American flag on the side of it. You know, we've got to win their hearts and minds, and help them get on their feet from 47 years of misery. And if we can do that, I think we can guide them, into a government that is going to be, you know, influenced more by us and is going to become a valued member of the Middle Eastern community.
No, very good points. Just for our viewing audience, when you mentioned like the Berlin Airlift, what exact, you know, time frame year wise was that, Dale?
I believe it was 1947, and no, I wasn't there. So,
well, I was going to say, I think you were actually doing intelligence work in the Pacific. That's why you were not able to be in Europe at the time, right? No, just had a bust on Dale a little bit. You know, we love him as an older brother I never had. So, I think really good, and we are at a really inflection point on world history at this exact point in time, fellas. Dale, you mentioned as far as, you know, like winning the hearts and minds of the Iranian people and Western culture and the United States, you know, winning them over. There was multiple reports we would read throughout the years of the GWAT that Iran actually had the most pro-American percentage population, pro-Western population out of any country in the Middle East. They were just ruled with an iron fist by their regime, by the Iranian, the Ayatollahs, with such a hardline stance. So again, like we talked about at the very beginning of the episode, here of the podcast, about some of the diplomatic relationships we used to have with Iran. So again, I think it's definitely an ultimate fuck around and find out moment for the Iranian regime. Again, the next, you know, several days to several weeks are going to be very telling on the future of Iran and really the future of the Middle East, you know, as a whole.
So, one thing I would add that again, most people probably aren't really aware, they haven't thought of, but the Iranian population is fairly young. Now, you know, they're approaching, you know, they're middle age now, I guess, their 40s or whatever. But people don't know or don't realize or don't remember the Iran-Iraq war. A couple of million of the cream of Iranian society, the young men of Iran, were killed. They were killed by Iraq during the Iran. They would send them against the Iraqi positions in mass waves, and they were just mowed down. You know, they were butchered. So the Iranian population is young, and they're more open to Western influences in that than what the older hardliners are that were big supporters of the Iranian Revolution when the Ayatollah came back in 79.
So, fellas, a lot of the Iranian people support Reza Pahlavi, the crown prince of Iran, some of Mohammad Reza Shah Pahlavi. Do you guys believe he represents a credible transitional figure? And what realistic role could he play in a post-regime government? And also, do you think that government could be democratic as well?
Well, from my perspective, I think he would be I don't see him being more than a temporary occupant of the Peacock Palace, the Peacock Throne in Tehran. I think he would be perhaps a temporary figure, may ultimately turn into something along the lines of the royal family in England, where you know, there's a government in place, but you have the royal family is the figurehead, as something to rally around or whatever. But I don't foresee him being more than a temporary figure as far as governing officials.
Do you think if the Islamic regime does fall, it is toppled, could we finally have true peace in the Middle East for the Shiites, the Sunnis, the Arabs, the Persians, the Jews. Do you think if the fall of the Iranian regime happens, could we actually achieve peace in the Middle East?
Well, if we move quickly and we control things, you know, by ensuring that we get again, that we take care of the Iranian people, we get a leadership in place in that, the Iranian people want to be friends with the rest of the Middle East. And certainly the rest of the Middle East, you know, wants to have a good relationship with Iran. So, you know, there is the opportunity to have a true peace in the Middle East as a result of the Iranian regime falling. But again, we have to act quickly to assert our control and our influence. Otherwise, it's going to get out of our hands.
Mike, over to you for your thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, is there ever going to be a symbiotic, you know, community there with all the Middle Eastern nations working together? I don't think so. Could it be a lot better than it is now, where it's a lot more settled and people aren't worried on a day-to-day basis what's going to happen next? Yes, I think if we got in and, you know, replaced the regime and worked hard. I mean, this isn't the first time we've done this as a nation, right? We've gone into other countries before and kind of had to, you know, take care of their regime or however you want to place it. But we've done these operations before. But I think that Dell is right. We'd have to get in there very quickly afterwards, make sure things were settled, and then get back out. But are they ever going to be these wars have been going on for 2,000 years and these disagreements. And we're talking about, you know, vast differences in religious beliefs and stuff. So do I think that it'll be all symbiotic and right away? No, but I think it will be a lot better than it is now.
Well, Mike, I will have to respectfully just slightly disagree with you on that point as far as can we ever actually get, like, you know, any type of, you know, diplomatic relationships. And I think my example I'm going to give is the Abraham Accords. So President Trump, during the end of his first term, was able to get the Abraham Accords. We had five Arab Gulf states in Israel signing pretty much a diplomatic, you know, kind of a partnership. I think if we can get their Iranian regime toppled and we can get a democratic established, you know, pro-Western, other factions of the Middle East, Iran, you know, leadership in Iran, and we can add them potentially to the Abraham Accords, I think it will be one of the most historic peace treaties and peace deal this world has ever seen. I mean, well, where am I going wrong on that one, yeah. Fellas? What are your thoughts?
No, I mean, I agree with you, Trey, that it would be obviously a huge step in the right direction in what we need to do and ultimately strive for. Would it be amazing? Sure. How long would it last? That I don't know, you know, with all the different, you know, differences in beliefs and the war between the oil nations down there. There's just so many different factors that come into play in the geopolitical space that would they ever like get along? They might get along on paper. They might get along because it's in the best interest of their economies at the time. But I just worry that, you know, eventually that will have to be, you know, that could potentially fall, my opinion.
Yeah. Dell, what are your thoughts? Where am I going wrong?
Well, I mean, I spent about 5 years in the Middle East and, you know, in Iraq, United Arab Emirates. And I know from my experience of that and talking with the Arabs, they are getting tired of all the fighting. And if you look at, how they're changing their countries and that with all of the construction going on, with all of the Western influences that they're inviting into their country. You know, they're hosting golf tournaments in Abu Dhabi and in Saudi Arabia now. They're, you know, their construction is going all over the place. They like the lifestyle that they're building, which is one of the reasons why they supported the removal of the Iranian regime, because they got a lot of money invested in building their cities and their countries up. They don't want to see it destroyed by war. So I think that alone is going to be an incentive for them to, even if things get, you know, a little blustery at times between them and one of the other Gulf nations, you know, they'll work it out because they've got too much to lose. So, I mean, I think that's what it comes down to. They've got too damn much to lose.
No, all fantastic points, gentlemen. I think no matter how this Iranian current regime, how things pan out with them, the most important thing or the most important discussion point is it's undeniable, is strong leadership from the United States will determine peace in the Middle East and peace going forward worldwide for that from that perspective. So I don't think anyone can deny that if you have strong leadership in the beltway of the United States in Washington, D.C. They can help steer policy for both from our adversaries, but also our allies overseas as well. All right, fellas, what's the final position of the panel here? Do we go in and remove the Iranian regime with force if necessary or no?
Yeah, I don't think we have a choice. I think it needs to happen. It needs to be surgical. It needs to happen fast, but it definitely needs to happen.
Well, I mean, I think the only solution is regime change. We need to go in and kick the living shit out of them so that they know, you know, that they've pissed off the United States one too many times over all these years.
No, I concur, gentlemen. This is definitely a inflection point in world history. I think it's time for the Iranian regime to be ended once and for all. They have caused far too many atrocities throughout with their country on their own citizens, the Middle East, and the world itself. I think it's finally time for us to go in there, like you guys said, use swift, military, decisive action to end this regime and turn that country back over to the Iranian people. All right, fellas. We will definitely come back if there's any more additional developments on the situation in Iran. But that's all the time we have for today, folks. Thank you, gentlemen, again, for sharing your expertise and personal connections on this subject. I think we will be hearing a lot more about Iran in the coming weeks, if not days. If you enjoy the content from today's episode, please like and subscribe to become a founding member of Proud American Studios. Go to ProudAmericanStudios.com and also see what else we are working on. We appreciate you joining us, and we will see you again soon.